reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott, and yeah, we've got a show today. My guest today is Greg Michelson. He is the other half of Unbridled Books. I already talked to Fred Ramey a few weeks ago, and today we're getting the other half, the other side of the argument, the other brain that mixes with the other brain that does really great stuff in the publishing world. I'm a little tired, a little worn out. It's been a busy week. It's going to be a busy week again going forward. The Writer's Salon is coming up on Saturday, which is always a good time. Lots of drink will be had. Let's see, some news before we jump into my conversation with Greg Michelson. As you know, I had been doing the Shop Talk episodes with my friend from graduate school, Laura Holly, and she, of course, is a little distracted and drawn in different directions lately. She's been focusing on advancing her nursing education, and she's getting married in a couple of months. And although she did recently have a short story accepted by Junoesque, an online journal, recently, she wasn't feeling like she was really contributing to the Shop Talk shows, even though I was more than happy to talk with her. I think we both kind of agreed it was a little bit one-sided. And, you know, part of the reason I don't do big intros is because I'm a little self-conscious about rambling aimlessly with a lot of pauses, and maybe you do or do not like to hear it. Maybe you fast-forward through this stuff the way people do with Marin's podcast or other podcasts. I know I do it with a few. But anyway, wanting to keep up a show like the Shop Talk episodes and hopefully branch out and do some other things, I've extended an invite to another grad school friend of mine. We're going to discuss some ways we might go forward and do another section of the podcast, kind of like Shop Talk, but maybe change it up and do a few other things. We're working that out now, so hopefully we'll get those out here soon. And I'm hoping that now that the writer's salons that I've been hosting here in my apartment have become consistent enough that we can start scheduling events. And what I'd like to do is have some panel discussions with some of the published writers or other people here to kind of, you know, generate some conversations and some ideas and whatnot. And, of course, record those for a third stream of the Outrider podcast. I am very interested in not doing just the one thing, which is have conversations with new writers every month, or established writers who I've never met before, or whatnot, but have an ongoing dialogue with another writer friend of mine, which would be our new version of the Shop Talk, whatever it is we come up with that, but also do some more interactive things, which would be the panel discussions, like live episodes. So we'll see where that goes. But anyway, let's get on with today's show and hear from the other half of Unbridled Books, Greg Michelson. Stuff they both cared about.
Yeah. Okay.
So kind of that, but about books.
Okay. And you'll clean it up before it all goes out, right?
Well, if we have anything that you feel is you don't want out there, we can cut that out. But most of the time, it's pretty raw. In fact, what we've been chatting about here will probably end up going out there as well.
Okay.
Just because, like I said, I try to keep it as organic as possible. I don't even do a whole lot of research most of the time.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Let's have at it.
All right. Well, I always like to start somewhere at the beginning. And as you know, I've already talked to Fred.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys got started in your little literary collaboration at the University of Missouri.
Yeah, we were graduate students together and had desks and cubicles next to each other. So we started arguing way back then.
Yeah, that's what he said. There's the what should and should not go into a novel, and he kind of didn't want to go much deeper than that. But I'm going to pick. I'm going to see if I can get it out of you. But I doubt I will. He was pretty adamant that there's a certain magic to it that he doesn't want out there. Because next thing you know, he'll end up getting a lot of bug books and you'll get horse books and it'll never be a...
Yeah. I mean, yeah. People ask me all the time, although they used to do it more than they do now, that, you know, which one of us likes which, what kind of book.
Right.
You know, and the truth is, I mean, we talk about what makes good fiction between ourselves, between the two of us, a lot, even today.
Yeah.
You know, and we argue this and that, and we do both certainly have different, some different ideas, but we have a large area in the middle where we meet, and that's those are the books that we tend to go for. And you know, I tell people, and it really is true, it doesn't matter which one of us in a lot of ways read something first, because we both have to agree
right
before we go forward on a book. I mean, I think that's particularly important for the kind of publishing we do.
Mm-hmm.
And for as small as we are,
right.
You know, that everybody has to be, you know, everybody's egos have to be involved in every book we do.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of the thing I love the most about small presses is, you know, they don't put a book out just because they think it'll make money. They put it out because they think it'll do well, because they have a passion for that book. And they'll get out and stand up for it and go to bat for it. And that's missing in a lot of publishing these days sometimes, I think, my opinion.
Well, I mean, it definitely is. Which is not to say there aren't editors at big houses who love
right.
some of the books they do.
Absolutely.
It's a completely different landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both, you know, Fred and I had a taste of that for a while, so.
Yeah. Now, you guys really began the collaboration with, I mean, the business collaboration with McMurray and Beck, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Now, but at the same time, you were also doing work with the Missouri Review.
Yeah, I was with the Missouri Review almost from the first issue.
Wow.
Through about the first 20 years of the magazine. So that's really where, you know, my... literary and editing background came from.
Mm-hmm.
That and you know, a couple of mentors, I guess literary mentors, that I was lucky enough to have.
Who were they?
Early on, one was Bill Peden, William Peden, who was a professor here.
Mm-hmm.
Who founded the University of Missouri Press. He had been at one point chair of the English department. He was an anthologist, a well-known anthologist and expert in the short story, with a degree in history from University of Virginia. He was a Jeffersonian scholar, actually, but made his, you know... He got on in English faculties, you know, because of his, you know, because of his knowledge and understanding
right.
and interest in writing, you know, back in the days before things were quite as buttoned down as they are now.
Right. So there was a wild and crazy English department day somewhere in the past, right?
Well, yeah, but we won't talk about that part.
But, I would love to hear about it because mine was a little bit buttoned down. I mean,
yeah. Well, yeah. Let's don't go there. But at any rate, you know, Bill Peden was, you know, back in, I want to say probably the late 50s and uh-huh. early 60s was really one of the leading anthologists. Uh-huh. He was one of the first people to anthologize Kafka in the United States and one of the first to anthologize, you know, some of the younger El Boom, you know, writers, Juan Rulfo and some of those people.
All right.
So, and his wife is Margaret Sayers Peden, who's the translator of, of Isabel Allende and Fuentes and all kinds of all kinds of really fine writers.
Yeah.
She taught. She had been his student and taught in the Spanish department.
Who was the other influence?
There's Tom McAfee,
I think,
who was a poet,
okay, right,
and fiction writer, whose novel Rover Youngblood was a finalist for the National Book Award, and had been talked about as a Pulitzer Prize candidate back in the day, and he was a short story writer as well. And also wrote a lot of poetry. I mean, primarily, probably his career was in, as a poet.
Can you find his book still outside of a library?
Well, you know, it's convenient that you've asked. The short answer to that at the moment is no.
Oh, wow.
But the slightly longer answer is that by spring you will be.
Oh, really?
Because he died, gosh, he died right, I think he was about 50, I want to say it was in 82.
Oh, wow.
It was, because it was right after my son was born. And a lot of his work, you know, fell out of print in, in spite of several of, you know, pretty well-known poets that who corresponded with him and, who supported his work. But here a few years ago, a group of his former students, led really by Ted Schaefer, a poet, and his wife, and Jerry Deathrow, who you know, was one of Tom's students, and he stayed here in town. He owned the famous Columbia Bar, Booch's, which is the oldest bar in at least in Boone County, and famous for its hamburgers. But he also, they were written up at one point in the New Yorker as, you know, one of the, having one of the five best hamburgers in the country or something like that. But at any rate, Booch's, Booch's Billiards Hall was, he and a couple of his fellow students bought it and ran it and actually for years published a small literary magazine out of there called La Booch Review. So anyway, Jerry and Ted Schaefer and his wife and Kay Benetti, who you know, at one time ran directed, well, she created and directed the American Audio Prose Library, which is a national treasure to this day. Got together and I got involved a little bit, and we went through all of his old books and all of his papers, and we are bringing out this spring in by through BKMK Press.
Oh yeah,
you know, Bookmark Press in in Kansas City. His selected poems.
Oh, cool.
So, and it's a pretty comprehensive book with at least half a dozen poems out of every collection that he did, and there's a number of them, and then a section of previously uncollected, and even a few unpublished poems that he had before, you know, he had finished right before he died.
Oh wow!
So, so yeah, we're gonna bring him back to life. I'm really excited about that.
I'll keep an eye out for him
because he's one of the dearest people I ever knew, and somebody who to this day I miss.
Yeah.
One of the gentlest people I ever knew. So yeah, we're really excited about it. And I just got page proofs for it last week from BKMK, and just reading through the page proofs again and rereading those poems, it's amazing to me, you know, what a wonderful poet the guy was. And you can can just hear his voice through those poems. It just comes right back. So it's a project that I'm really happy about.
Well, good. That sounds great. I love that about poetry in particular, but all writing, is that there's always that echo of the person, and having known someone, I'm sure that's a lot stronger than just my own, occasionally having heard an audio recording somewhere and then picking up like a Ginsberg poem or something and going, I get why this is important, why that's significant, even if it's only significant to a small number of people.
Well, you know, I started out Tom's student, and really always was, but we got to be very close friends along the way and over the years. And he's somebody who should not be forgotten. His work should not be forgotten, and I'm really thrilled about bringing it back, getting the chance to be part of that project, bring it back anyway.
Now, you also do a bit of writing, correct? Or have in the past? Or?
I did in the past. I haven't for years. I don't know exactly why, you know, and I may again here soon if I retire anytime soon. I may start writing again, and every once in a while I feel the urge, but it's a little bit of, I'm a little conflicted about working as an editor and publisher and writing my own stuff at the same time, I guess.
How so?
Well, I don't know. It feels a little bit like a conflict, editing requires a different mindset.
Right. Oh yeah, it does.
And it's hard to push back and forth. I mean, I guess I feel like publishing, especially publishing a small press, the way we do, is more of a lifestyle, you know, than it is a job.
Right.
And carving out the kind of time that I would need to write, because I discovered early on, I wrote poetry, and I wrote short stories. But I early on discovered that I had more of a rhythm for novels.
Right.
And trying to make the time commitment to do that edit, you know, and run a small press and, you know, raise a family and
you
take care of horses,
a bit thin,
you know.
Trying to
take care of all the horses at the same time. It was just too much.
That's right. You're raising thoroughbreds, correct?
Well, I have, and I do still have some thoroughbreds. These days, the business has kind of morphed to show jumpers and those, because my daughter is much more involved in the business with me now, and that's what she has done for a living. For probably about the first 10 years that she was out of high school, she did.
Wow.
Now she's working somewhere else, but still doing a lot of work with the horses and mm-hmm. still, keeping her hand in that part of the of the world. So,
right. so you have a ranch.
Well, yeah, a horse farm. I wouldn't call it a ranch. Maybe out in Kansas where you guys have all that room and plains.
It's all mostly privately owned stuff. There's very little. I think I read somewhere once that per capita there's less public land in Kansas than anywhere else. It's all
Is that
divided.
Right?
Yeah, per capita. I mean, not actually in land mass space, but yeah, a lot of it's divided up into farms, and there are a few nature preserves like the tall grass prairie up in the Flint Hills and all that stuff. That's kind of set aside as public land, but most of it's farms and cattle ranches. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, although I used to race horses over there in Kansas quite a bit back in the day.
Whereabouts? Whereabouts?
Where did Eureka? I think I think there's still a track there at Eureka. There was quite a good little track there, and in Emporia.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be a place there called Blue Stem Downs. We used to race over there.
Wow.
A lot, that was back in the day where there was just a grandstand and some starting gates and a fat man with two handfuls of money sitting on the bench over there. Or you could bet.
People still wearing slouch hats in the stands and driving Studebakers.
Well, no, I'm not that old.
Well, there's some. Somebody at the track who was that old.
This would have been in the 70s.
Yeah,
we did once haul up there though, and to I guess this must have been at Eureka, at Eureka Downs, with a 3-year-old quarter horse filly, and raced against. There was one of these classic, right out of classic Western, grade B Western movies, a great big Texan who'd driven up with his, in his white Cadillac with red leather interior and a pair of longhorns.
On the hood?
On the hood as a hood ornament.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, did his horse win?
We outran him. He was pretty ticked off about that. But
way to go.
He had a good horse.
Yeah.
He had a good horse, but we happened to have a real good horse at that point. So
you did miss with Texas.
Well, those were the old days. I did that while I was a graduate student, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've been fascinated. I've always been fascinated by horses, loved horses. My mom was a big horse person. She wanted to raise horses, but it never worked out for her. I mean, she was a preacher's kid, so there was always a little bit other things going on and too much moving around. And
I mean, horses keep you pretty housebound.
Yeah.
They're worse than kids that way, really.
I haven't been on a horse since I was 12 or 13. Ah. And, of course, every time I've been on a horse 3 different times, and each time I fell off.
well, You just get back on.
Oh, I did. I did. Yeah. Of course, I spent my cousin, one of my cousins who lived up around Salina, had a horse, this huge Palomino named Chief. And my aunt took me out one day. My parents had gone off to a vacation in Colorado, and we stayed, my sister and I stayed with my aunt up in Bennington. She took us out to go ride the horse one day and stuck me on Chief. And of course, I was 13 years old, and my cousin Valerie was a year older, so she had grown a couple inches taller than me at that point, and nobody adjusted the stirrups on the saddle. So I'd get on the horse, and I'm riding with my legs stuck out so that I can get my feet into the bottom of the stirrup, right? And helpfully, my aunt says, no, you're supposed to ride with your feet against the side of the horse. I took her advice, and of course, the horse took off, and I wasn't doing anything except kicking the horse a little bit more, and the stirrups flew away, and next thing I know, I'm riding up on the neck of the horse, and, you know, getting hit with the pommel, and I've got my arms around the neck, and the horse just keeps going faster and faster. And
I'm probably scaring him.
I was scared, and he was probably scared. and I remember thinking to myself, just let go, it won't hurt. And fortunately, about halfway between where I let go and where I hit the ground, I passed out and was unconscious because I landed on my head.
Ooh, yeah, well,
and I think
that
could
be pretty dangerous.
It was. I think if I had been conscious, I would have tried to break my fall and broke my neck. Unfortunately, I just had a concussion and spent 3 days unconscious.
Really?
Yeah. Ooh. And the day after I woke up, my parents had come back from Colorado, and my mother, very determined person, says, you're not going to be scared of horses. And so she took me back out to the horse farm and put me on a different horse. And then she got on my cousin's horse, Chief, and we rode out together about a mile up the road, and then we turned around and just, you know, walking and trotting and stuff like this to keep it calm. And I had an appropriately sized saddle. And we turned around, and my mom says, well, I'm going to let him run back to the barn. I was like, okay. So she took off on that horse, and my horse wanted to run too.
Yeah.
But I pulled back on the reins, and then apparently was doing a Lone Ranger type of thing in the middle of the road. The horse up on its hind legs, and then it bolted to the left and got caught, tried to jump over a fence and got caught, and fell backwards on its rump on the road and shot me out of the back of the saddle.
Well, you're lucky to be around telling these stories, actually.
Yeah. Well, I landed on my ass that time, so it was more comfortable. And I laid there in the road for a little bit laughing, so I thought it was damn funny. And then did my mother proud and got back on the horse and rode it back to the barn.
Well, you were lucky. That's all I can say.
Yeah, that's what I... But So those are my horse stories.
Yeah, so you haven't really had the best of experiences with
I'd
horses.
Do it again, but I would need some boots and some training.
Yeah. Well, everybody should learn how to do it if they're going to do it.
Right.
So. Well, I don't know anybody who's been around horses who hasn't fallen off.
So. Yeah. It's kind of the way it goes.
Yeah.
Dealing with a live animal there.
Yeah.
So, what's it, going back to the balance between editing and publishing and writing, because I'm curious about, you know, some more of your thoughts on that, because I've been trying to do a little bit of something like that as a way of kind of keeping myself engaged in a literary scene, especially here in Wichita, which doesn't seem to have a very active scene as far as, you know, readings and the MFA program here is kind of insular.
I've tried
some publication stuff, you know, with my old DIY journal and then some friends from around the country trying this thing called, we're calling Unoya Solstice, and we've been, you know, a lot of false starts with that. So I'm curious, what...
Well, I don't think it's a, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing for writers to also be editors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my God, if writers didn't work as editors, particularly at the in the literary magazine world,
right?
There wouldn't be any literary magazines. And, you know, I think you learn a lot as a writer by editing.
Mm-hmm.
For that matter, I think you learn a lot as a writer just by reading a slush pile for a few months.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Because you learn all of those things that, you know, what it does is it drills into your brain all of those little things that even if you're in a workshop, even,
mm-hmm.
you sort of quibble about and people argue about. And,
right.
And you might know, well, I'm being indulgent here, or this was too easy here, or, you know, but it doesn't really get driven home to you. At least it didn't for me, until, you know, you're reading 500, you know, stories a week.
Right.
You know? And four of them have those exact problems.
Right.
Or 400 of them have, out of the 500, have those exact problems. And you get to the point where if you see it again, you know, you think you want to shoot yourself in the head or something.
Right.
So you learn what works and what doesn't work.
Right.
You know, and you get it over and over again. And you have to think about writing in a critical way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and one of the differences, and, you know, I talked about mindset. I mean, one of the differences in editing, the critic is there all the time.
Right.
When you write, you can't have that critic.
Oh, absolutely.
Turned on. You know, you have to let yourself write. You know, and there is always a little, you know, voice sort of up and behind your right ear or whatever.
Yeah, I'm this familiar with that.
About asshole. What you're, you know, what you're doing, you know. But I think to write, particularly a fiction writer,
uh-huh.
you have to be able to turn that thing off for a while, you know.
Yeah,
and that's one of the things that makes it a real different enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think good writing is good writing, and good writers
right.
Make great editors, and great editors can make good writers. But they really are, it's two different gears.
Right. Oh, yeah. I've noticed that. The little bit of editing that I've done, either through the journal or the website we've tried to launch, it's just, you know, finding that, asking yourself what, well, I guess it was one of my early professors in workshop, Steve Heller.
Oh, yeah.
Who said that, you know, you should, he called it the disinterested reader. Not someone who's uninterested, but someone who stands back and disconnects their own interest in what they want a story to be and just addresses that story right in front of them about what it wants to be. What expectations does it create? Does it meet those expectations or subvert them appropriately? And wrestle with that. And that's served me well, I think, in both workshops and trying to do what little editing I've done so far.
Yeah, I would put it a little differently.
Uh-huh.
I think as an editor, particularly for fiction, but you know, I was also for several years a poetry editor at the Missouri Review,
mm-hmm.
And I was pretty hands-on editing poets as well. Many of whom didn't really take that very well, mostly because they weren't used to it. You know?
Right,
but. You know, that's a different story. I mean, I think the key to being a really good editor at least of especially of full-length manuscripts, uh-huh. is you can't really be the disinterested reader, because that doesn't quite work.
Right.
But what you need to be, I think, what you need to be able to do is not say, how would I solve this problem?
Right.
You know, or how would I do this? Mm-hmm. What you have to do is learn to do your best to understand the imagination of the mm-hmm. of the author, and try to put yourself in the author's place.
Right.
And say, you know, what's he getting at, and how would he really do this if he had the time or the distance mm-hmm. to do it? Because when, you know, particularly when you're writing a long work, and I'm sure you know this well,
yeah.
you go over it and over it, and it's such a long piece,
right.
that there's so many different parts to it that you become snowblind.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I find there's a bit of amnesia involved with it as well, because it sometimes takes me, a year, maybe 18 months to get a rough draft finished, and by the time I get to the end of it, I've kind of forgot what I did in the early pages.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard yeah. to catch those missteps sometimes, because you know what you meant to do, and so the brain just kind of wipes it out and says, oh, yeah, I did that, and you didn't. Are there...
But at any rate, I guess my point finally is that, you know, writers can make fine editors.
Mm-hmm.
I just found that there was I came to a point where I didn't have enough creative energy to do both things at the same time.
Right, right. So kind of drifting back to the slush pile, do you have off the top of your head a list of the horrible things you hope you never see again? I mean, we don't want to get you stuck with a lot
yeah,
of certain
no,
types of books,
I,
but we can. But
I,
let's see if
I
we can put it out
do.
There.
You know them when you see them. You know, I mean, I hate to say that there's so many.
Oh, so, but, yeah, we don't want to completely dry up your slush pile, but.
But you know, I mean, it really depends. I mean, you know what when I'm reading, I focus on the quality of the prose mm-hmm. and also the narrative voice, you know, and then I worry about the, you know, characters and setting and pace and timing. And
right, right.
I mean, a good piece has to have everything these days.
Almost, yeah.
So, and, you know, it's easy to fall down in any of those places.
So who were some of the writers that, you know, got you turned on when you were starting to read and starting to think about, you know, getting degrees in English and so forth? Who were they?
Oh, well, you know, I grew up with, I actually had a fairly eclectic reading background, I
uh-huh.
think. Which is probably to say haphazard.
Yeah, I know that one.
But, you know, and I'm not, you know, I can't say as I'm particularly well-read. You know, mm-hmm. Almost everybody I work with seems to be better read than I am. But
I know that feeling, too.
But, you know, early on, I mean, it was the classic bunch,
mm-hmm.
you know, Faulkner and Hemingway,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Mailer, Somerset Maugham,
Flannery
O'Connor, Grace Paley.
Uh-huh.
A lot of those writers.
Hmm.
So, John Cheever, I guess, maybe a little bit.
Maybe
that was a little later. In graduate school, or when I first, would start teaching writing a little bit, and when I first started really editing and publishing, and I'd go to a workshop or something, and people would ask me things. I think at one point, I would sort of glibly say that, there's three or four writers, contemporary writers, who you should be reading. I mean, I was reminded of this actually just last week because of Robert Stone's death.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And Robert Stone was one of them. I think for that sort of post-60s writer, if you read Robert Stone,
I have
Toni
not.
Morrison, Don DeLillo,
uh-huh.
William Gaddis, Garcia Marquez, Alejo Carpentier, actually a lot of the Spanish-American writers, Alejo Carpentier, Jorge Amado, Garcia Marquez.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in, I was still an undergraduate, come to think of it.
Yeah.
Actually, I might have been out of school. It was before it was probably before I got a degree.
Right.
I was living in a trailer with three Cubans. and reading 100 Years of Solitude in Spanish, trying to, with a English edition next to me and the Cubans who would come and try to, he wrote in such a different dialect than they had grown up with that there was times they didn't quite know what he was saying either.
Oh, wow. So was Carver kind of still, was he looming large
Carver?
Over everything at that point?
Raymond Carver?
Yeah.
I guess he was. I mean, early in his career, I helped edit a special fiction section in the Missouri Review of three or four of his short stories.
Oh, wow.
Back when probably I think he had just maybe one collection out. But yeah, he got to be sure.
Yeah.
Because
by the time I was an undergrad in the early
90s.
Yeah,
all the minimalists and blue collar trailer park fiction people.
Because that was the thing.
Rose.
In the early 90s when I was an undergrad taking workshops, that was Hemingway and Carver were like, these weird presences in the room in a workshop. Everybody was shooting for that kind of, tough, gritty, minimalist, voice thing. And
yeah. See, when I was going to school, people wouldn't even read Hemingway.
Really?
Because he was too sexist.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I can remember a revolt in one of my literature classes among the women students who saw him on the syllabus and refused to read him.
Yeah, I had a professor I took a lit course from when I was an undergrad who was a feminist critic, a man. And when we came to the section where I don't know why he even bothered to put the Hemingway book on the syllabus, I guess because he felt he had to at some point. But he was a feminist critic, and so when we came to the Hemingway section, he took a trip and brought in a substitute to teach that section.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I was kind of...
I'm fine with whatever anybody thinks about him. I get why people call him sexist, but I actually... and he might have been in real life. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't really think his fiction is all that sexist necessarily. I think he's got some pretty strong women characters often.
Yeah. Well, at the time, the men's movement was quite big. You know, there was Iron John with, I can't remember the poet's name that wrote that book. And then Fire in the Belly by Sam Keane and all this, you know, there was the rise of the early stage of the men's movement. And a therapist had given me a Fire in the Belly by Sam Keane, and I had read that right at the same time that I was in this lit course with the feminist professor. And so, you know, the kind of student and my mentality was that since he didn't want to teach Hemingway or take Hemingway seriously, I was going to write my big paper about Hemingway. And I was going to take this new sort of men's movement, you know, philosophical approach to it. And I was arguing that Hemingway wasn't, you know, a sexist machismo, you know, anti-feminist, but instead what he was doing with his work was questioning the traditional masculine gender stereotype.
How did that work out for you?
Oh, I passed. So I think it went pretty well, but I've always been kind of fascinated by that angle of it, and also the fact that whatever Hemingway really was as a person, he was a good enough writer that the stories can bear multiple divergent and conflicting interpretations and still hold up. That's impressive.
Oh, yeah. His short stories are, many of them are just real gems.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
But, I have to say that my reading has always been pretty haphazard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just recently had picked up Jim Crumley. As a recommendation from Scott Phillips.
The Last Good Kiss.
Yep, that's the one.
And what's the other one? The Dancing Bear.
Okay.
I believe. Is that right? Anyway, yeah, he's
interesting.
Obviously he's a larger than life writer. Mm-hmm.
So, which Robert Stone should I pick up first? Because I'm always looking for recommendations.
Yeah, other people would probably recommend different ones.
Uh-huh.
My personal favorite is A Flag for Sunrise.
A Flag for Sunrise. Okay.
Outer Bridge Reach, too, is really
an
amazing book.
I think my friend Todd had recommended that one to me a while back, and I've never picked it up.
Yeah.
Not because I was resisting his recommendation, but because, you know, my own haphazard reading habits is it's on a list somewhere on my computer, and I just walk into the store and never think to order it.
A Flag for Sunrise is one of those books that every once in a while I used to go back to reread just to recharge my juices.
Yeah.
You know, remind myself what I thought really fine writing was like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he, like many writers, occasionally overindulges. not like Crumley, but but at his best, he's just an amazing writer.
Now every book on the Unbridled list is good, and Fred will be happy to hear this. I'm including mine. But what are those moments like when you're going through the submissions at Unbridled, and you're going through the slush pile, and you find that something?
It's exciting, you know. And it's the thing you live for. If you're an editor at a publishing company. The moment when you realize you've just gotten lost in time reading a manuscript that you had no idea about when you started is just exciting. You know, it really is. Huh. I mean, it is the reason. It is the thing that you're hoping for.
Right, right.
All the time, you know, and I do think, I mean, I appreciate what you said about Unbridled, but I agree with you. I mean, we've turned down a lot of awfully good books
over
the years. I've always actually been, not always, but fairly comfortable saying no, mostly because I think if a book is really good and I'm making a mistake, somebody else out there won't.
Right, right.
And I also, among the things that I learned as a literary magazine worker is that it's always better to be sorry that you didn't publish something rather than to be sorry that you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So yeah. I think we are really careful, and we know that we've, you know, sometimes we've turned down books that have been very successful for other publishers, and I could understand why they were, and for the most part, you know, saw those strengths when we looked at it in the first place. But, you know, for one reason or another, it didn't work for us.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing for writers, especially young writers, to keep in mind, too, is that you know, all good editors have rejected and will continue to reject, as long as they're good editors,
right,
good work.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times, I mean, there's a vast number of reasons that you can't publish something even if you like it and admire it.
Right, right.
You know, and sometimes they're really very mundane, you know, as much as you know, okay, I can't publish another Civil War novel right now.
Right.
You know, or I can't publish another novel about China right now.
Right.
Or, you know, and I mean, there's just a whole number.
Right.
And truthfully, a lot of times when Fred and I are talking, one of the things we talk about is audience.
Uh-huh.
You know, where's the readership?
Right.
You know, we really like this book, but are we the faulty sampling? You know?
Right, right.
Or, you know, is this going to be a book that, you know, 300 people are going to form a cult and love it?
Yeah.
You know, and can we afford to do that?
Right.
You know?
Right. Do you ever have a situation where you pick up a book, you love it, but if you honestly assess yourself as an editor, you realize you're not the right editor to make this the best book it could be?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. That's comforting, actually.
Yeah. That does happen. And I have actually said that to writers and agents before.
Right.
You know, and occasionally have even suggested another house or editor who I happen to, you know, who I think might be more in sync. And a lot of times, you know, and the other thing about that in the editing process, I mean, I don't know firsthand your experience with Fred, but I can feel pretty confident that he was pretty hands-on with your manuscript.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm very hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things often before I accept or reject a book is that I often have a long or long-ish, or mm-hmm. actually sometimes maybe it's short, conversation, with the author.
Right, right.
To see if, there's some meeting of the minds
right.
about
and how
what should
they,
be done.
How willing
because,
are to take criticism.
Well, yeah, but, although I find anymore
mm-hmm.
that most fiction writers anyway, are pretty good about that.
Right, right.
Sometimes they're not, and if they're not, well, okay, good luck. But most of them are. But a lot of times, there could be, it's like you say, it's not a match.
Mm-hmm.
And my thoughts about where a book has to go,
right.
Just don't mesh with what the author wants to do.
Right, right.
Yeah. Or there's also times when the author will just say, well, yeah, maybe, but I like it the way it is right now, and I want to keep it out there for a while, and,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe I can't remember a particular time when they've done that and then later come back to me, but
right.
I'm pretty sure it's happened. So,
Yeah.
It's a relationship.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's one of the things. I find it, just my experience, originally with workshops and then with Fred and as I've given other manuscripts to people to read and ask for comments, it's one of the reasons that, I would never self-publish is because of that relationship with an editor, finding an editor that gets it and says, okay, if you want to do X, you've got to do this, you've got to move this, you've got to get rid of this.
Yeah.
Just because by the time I send it off to somebody, it's been, 2, 3, I don't know, it was 7 years before Fred took a look at The Evolution of Shadows. And I was sick and tired of looking at it. I was sick and tired of thinking about the problems that I had with it. I had gotten it to the point where I had both done everything I could do to it, and I was tired of thinking about other things I could do to it.
Yeah.
And there were still flaws, and there are still flaws now, but I think if you actually make something perfect, it's an offense to the universe. You should leave some flaws in there.
Well,
that's small ones, but
yeah, okay. Yeah, I think you should strive for perfection, but
mm-hmm.
Obviously. I mean, what does that even mean?
Right, right.
So when I talked with Fred about self-publishing and stuff like that, he was kind of in favor of it as a way of as one component of keeping a literary community alive. Where do you stand?
Well, he's both a smarter and nicer guy than I am.
you're the one I need to talk to right now. Because
I'm not going to say, I would never say that people shouldn't self-publish.
Right.
People should do whatever the heck they want to
mm-hmm.
do. But, I think it would be an exception to the rule to find a self-published book that was up to snuff.
Right, right, yeah.
I mean, for all of the obvious reasons.
Right.
I mean, I just think it's.
I think the person.
It's where people go who don't listen to editors.
It does seem that way.
Don't listen to suggestions.
Yeah.
And don't understand the process. And I mean, mm-hmm. I think, I get the issue of gatekeepers.
Right, right.
And that's probably really what Fred was getting at was there shouldn't be gatekeepers out there right. stopping people from, getting their, whatever they want mm-hmm. in the print. And obviously these days the technology is there to make that happen.
Right, right.
But I don't think in many ways that's necessarily a good thing.
Yeah.
I think a good editor and a thoughtful publisher is in almost every way superior to self-publishing, and even on almost every level, for the quality and the shape of the work itself, mm-hmm. for the presentation of the work itself,
yeah.
and for the way that most publishers can have the access that most publishers have to bookstores.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a distribution.
Yeah. Well,
and if you self-publish, I mean, plenty of self-published people are also great self-promoters.
Oh, yeah. And I'm horrible at self-promotion.
Well, most writers who I know, I don't know. Some of them are terrible. Most of them fall somewhere in the middle. You know, they can do it. They don't love it. Some of them love it, but in small doses.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in the end, you can spend your time trying to promote something that you've published yourself.
Right.
Or you can pass that job along to somebody else mm-hmm. and write some more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or help that person, I mean,
right.
Especially in this day and age, it's so challenging, in this current literary landscape.
Mm-hmm.
It's so difficult to get any attention or distribution.
Right. Yeah.
For even really tremendously good things.
Yeah.
The thing I did a lot of research into self-publishing, into the actual dynamics, because every time I would mention something on like Facebook or Twitter about agonizing over a query letter or whatever, someone from my past who was friends with or had self-published something would come up and be like, "Well, why don't you just self-publish?" And
yeah.
I'd be like, "So I actually did a bunch of research into the economics of self-publishing, and." I found was that if you can write fast and can come up with a serialized, thing where you crank out a new version every year, every 6 months, and you're willing to, go with Amazon and do a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, you can make a whole lot of money. There's some people out there that are making money on this track.
A few. Yeah. I don't think there's really very many.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of them who say
they are.
To hear
the self-publishers promote themselves, they like to tell everybody that theirs. But there's been kind of this weird dynamic in the public debate between the big five publishers and the self-publishers. And what everybody seems to ignore are presses like Unbridled or Grey Wolf or Coffee House that have open submission policies that aren't closed off to agented only manuscripts. these small presses that just do magnificent, I guess what you could almost call scout work, considering the number of unbridled authors that have later gotten, you know, picked up by the large houses.
Yeah.
Which, that's so frustrating. I've talked with everybody that, all of the unbridled authors that I've talked to, we've kind of brought that up, how that's got to be frustrating for you and for Fred, but also in a way kind of rewarding, you know, to find all these great authors and then watch them kind of fly the coop.
I mean, it is. It's, you know, it's mixed emotions.
I can hear the pain. I can, I can feel
it
across.
It is probably not the right time or place to go into all that.
Yeah,
but,
no, I understand.
But your point about that there's the big five publishers, mm-hmm. and then there's self-publishers, and all the little presses are getting lost, and so often get lumped then into the self-published
mm-hmm.
groups. I mean, the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, probably, that's really been when I've seen that occur. And once in a while, you know, we get lumped in that way,
mm-hmm.
at least in treatment.
Right.
You know, I think that happens more at the bookstore level.
Huh.
And social media level,
right?
Than anywhere else, and yeah, you do have to completely. I mean, we Unbridled has to oddly and somewhat defensively assert that, you know, we are not a vanity press,
right.
You know, and we are not a self-publisher,
right?
You know, I turned down I don't know how many hundreds of manuscripts for every one that we publish.
Yep.
You know, and which is not to say that some of those others shouldn't go out and self-publish them,
mm-hmm.
but it's a difference in kind. It really is.
Right, right. Well, it kind of leads me into the question I try to ask everybody, and this will kind of be the last question we can wrap it up so you can get on with your day here. We have this conflict, you know, the big five have their celebrity publishing model. You know, they rely on those big mm-hmm. name books to haul in all this money so they can do, you know, 4 or 5, you know, passion projects throughout the year. And then on the other end, you have Amazon trying to take over the book industry and winning all these converts through their self-publishing and all these people who seem to miss what I call the Darth Vader clause in the Amazon agreement, which is Amazon reserves the right to change the terms of the contract at any time without the writer's approval or knowledge. And then you have all the small presses out there. So this is kind of the economic and gateway environment for the writer. But on the other end, you have the reader out there. And the National Endowment for the Arts does their study every year, and they find, according to their numbers, literary reading is declining. People are mm-hmm. reading less and less novels, less and less poetry, fewer plays.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this impression they present that literacy is declining. But then you take a look at those numbers for e-readers and bookstore sales even, and the numbers are going up.
Well, no, I don't think that's right. I think the numbers for bookstore sales, I mean, the numbers of ebooks are going up because
right.
it's a new, you know, it's a new mm-hmm. thing. I don't think particularly in among literary titles,
right.
literary imprints, I don't think anybody's bottom line that's a traditional publisher.
Oh, right, right.
Looks, you know, I don't think ebooks are more than about 10% of their business.
Right, right.
So, you know, you're still talking about a small segment of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe the number of books being sold go up, but I don't think the number of literary titles go up. And,
right.
I'm pretty sure that, the number of sales, I'm pretty sure that you don't need nearly as many sales to get on the New York Times bestseller mm-hmm. list even.
Right.
Than you did 5 years ago.
But
there's fewer bookstores.
Right, right.
And there's far more product,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better term.
Right.
It's much more consolidated.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers for bookstores, I think, you know, may be going up, but a lot of that's in nonfiction and children's books.
Right.
Specialty
right.
titles, and not in
right
literary
yeah.
fiction.
And the bulk of the sales through Amazon are for the genre fiction. And for the stuff that gets serialized. So that's but what you're seeing with that, and this is kind of what I was driving at, is you have for that serialized genre, basically what I've started referring to as written television.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know,
it really is. And
right.
Go ahead. Let me finish
your
point.
But it's that niche thing, and people seem to really want to read that because they can get it on their Kindle and e-reader and crank through it because it's usually really short and easy to digest, and they get one every month or every 6 months or every year or whatever, and they just go through this series. Oh, here are these characters I like and that's familiar, and people like to read that. And I have a whole theory about how we teach literature that leads to people shying away from what you and I would call literature, serious work, and embracing the purely entertainment genre stuff. We've kind of created...
Yeah. I mean, I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
Oh, exactly. They're not.
In any way.
But publishing is because of the genre pigeonholes they've tried to place on everything.
Yeah, but that's always been the case, I think.
Right.
It's probably more so now, but I think it's always
mm-hmm.
it's always been the case. I actually think that one of the things you said has stuck with me, and I've been arguing for a while now. It's the TV drama aspect of it.
Right, right.
But you know what it really is, and what I think is the biggest elephant in the room, the competitor mm-hmm. in the room that is hurting, in particular, a certain kind of literary sale. The kind of literary. I mean, I hate using the word literary fiction, or the term literary fiction, particularly attaching it to what we do at Unbridled, because
uh-huh.
I think of it as quality fiction,
right,
and not literary fiction, and it's because of that connotation. You know, I mean, stuff has to happen in our books, you know,
right,
and it has to be meaningful stuff that people care about.
Right.
You know, there has to be tension and conflict,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all those commercial hooks. But you know what we fight against, I think, and what's hurting us more than anything else are the cable series,
uh-huh.
you know, and Netflix and Hulu, because I'm perfectly serious about
right?
this.
No, I get it.
Because you can sit down on TV, and I do this too, you
uh-huh.
know, you can sit down and decide to watch. I mean, they put together 6 or 8 hours of, in some
oh, yeah.
cases, high quality.
Oh yeah.
You know, stuff in which they have enough room to create character depth,
right?
And to create relationships and create ongoing conflicts,
right?
And give you the reveal, you know, and movie on, you know, and right. you can sit down and you can watch, you know, an entire season.
Right, right. Somebody still had to write that stuff, though. There's
and the... people used to get that experience.
Uh-huh.
People used to have to sit down with a good novel.
Right.
Now they can sit down on Netflix and watch it.
Right.
And
watch disengage
it with
their actual
their
imagination.
Spouse or their friends.
Yeah.
And I think that that, more than anything else, is the current competitor for literary fiction, the thing that literary fiction
right.
has to compete against. And the reason that there's, you know, that sales are going down,
right.
even though the numbers of books, individual titles,
right.
are going up astronomically.
So that kind of gets to a more pointed version of the question that I always ask, is that as a writer, should I go into writing television, or what can I do out in the public? Because the literary environment is a sustainable environment. It should be a sustainable environment. We should feed back into it. What can the writer do to engage with the public in some way that feeds and sustains the urge to do that in the solitary way that literary that a book requires, as opposed to TV? Or should I just become a TV writer?
Well,
what can we do to
I, you know,
grow
I,
the
I
audience?
I think you should become the kind of writer that you know how to do,
I
and that you
novels.
Want to do.
Right.
You know, some people. I mean, I published not too long ago. These Things Happen by Richard Kramer, you know, which was the first novel. It was his debut novel,
right.
but he's had a decades-long career as a TV writer.
Mm-hmm.
And writing a novel was a completely different experience for him.
Right.
And one that he had a little trouble getting his arms around.
Mm-hmm.
And the editing process
right, right.
was completely different from anything he'd experienced, and also something that he had a little trouble getting his arms around
yeah.
to start with. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think you should, you know, if you're good at dialogue and stage direction and a certain type of plotting mm-hmm. and a certain kind of free association and pop culture, then I think go ahead and do TV writing. But I don't, you know, I think there's plenty of good novels that later
mm-hmm.
get made into TV series.
Right.
And plenty of not so good novels that turn into much better. I mean, I don't know if you're a Game of Thrones guy.
Nope.
But clearly, you know, that series has captured the imaginations of.
Oh, absolutely. And it's actually gotten the people to go out and read the books. You know?
Oh,
so,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, so it works both, you know, it works both ways. It used to be, though, that if a book got made into a major film,
mm-hmm.
That there'd be an immediate impact on book sales.
Right.
And that's not really the case anymore either. Yeah. You know, the problem is that nobody knows where the market is. You
right.
know, it's the landscape is so diffused.
Yeah.
And there's no place where everybody can go
right
now. And of course the internet is supposedly taking up the slack, but the internet has its own cliques and
deeply,
challenges and
deeply
and,
held flaws in the internet.
yeah. So, you know, I don't know the answer to I mean, if you're asking what can you do as a writer to engage the reading public, I mean, beyond the obvious things, I don't know. And if I did know, I'd be a millionaire. Nobody knows.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things, you know, I've
because
always...
Because there is no one thing that works over and over again.
Right, right.
You know, there's there doesn't seem to be that repeatable formula.
Yeah.
For by formula, I mean in the, you know, the marketing and distribution end of it, and engaging the, you know, the readership.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know the answer to it. I wish I did.
Yeah.
And I have long conversations that, you know, always end unsatisfactorily, unsatisfying, dissatisfyingly.
Yeah.
About it with all kinds of people.
My one solution that I, or at least the one that I cling to, is based totally on my experience as a student, particularly at high school. And I know a lot of people think, well, that was just your experience. You can't apply that to everything else. And I'm like going, well, if I had that experience, I can't be the only one. And, you know, my thing was that when I was in high school, I was not a terribly good student. So I was always in the average English course because I could obviously read better than the remedial kids, but I never did my homework, so I didn't have the grades for them to allow me into the advanced placement courses. And so I was stuck in a class that didn't get to read actual novels. They got to read the short stories in the school anthologies that they would buy. And from what I understand is that a lot of times those anthologies, they don't have a big budget, so they tend to buy the least expensive stories by good writers. So they're also not the most popular or even the best stories by, you know, people like your Hemingways and your Faulkners and your Paleys and
I don't really know how that works anymore.
Yeah. When I was in class, the teacher would, you know, 6 hours a day she would have of, you know, 20 or 30 students each hour, and she would get to the point where, or he would get to the point where the easiest thing to do each hour was to drive all the students to come up with the answers that had been provided in the textbook, in the teacher's version of the textbook. Yes, the blue cup in the story means this. And what I always felt was, I didn't get that. Does that mean that I don't understand the story, or it's just a terrible story, or am I stupid? And I think we scare a lot of people away from what has now become horribly named literary fiction, because we've trained them in high school that if they don't get what the teacher wants them to get from the story, then they're too stupid to understand that stuff, or it's bad.
Well, you know, that happens even more so when you get to college.
Right, right.
And for so long... I think this is less true now, but I might be wrong about that because spend much time with, you know, in university settings anymore. But I think that there was a long period of time, you know, half a century, in which, you know, several generations anyway, in which writers themselves deliberately tried to become more and more obscure and appeal to smaller and smaller elite literati.
Yeah, the poets did that really well.
Well, fiction writers did too. I mean, good God, look at James Joyce. And you know, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. But it's true. It was more poetry there for a long time. And, you know, that's because they had all given up on the idea that they would ever have a large readership.
Right, right.
And then, you know...
So I think maybe the,
and then set out to prove it.
Yeah.
So, and I, not just poets, but I mean, I, there was a whole, and not everybody either, but,
right.
But you know, I mean, for a long time it was like that, you know, and then, you know, literary criticism became so arcane for a while.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I guess probably still is. I mean, I don't know if they still have the Lacanians and the Derridas and everybody out there.
I think they still do.
Doing that stuff, but.
So maybe that's the key then. We as writers just need to refuse to accept a small readership and demand and fight for as.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
As wide as possible.
I definitely think so. I mean, I used to, at the Missouri Review, I used to always argue that the potential readership for literary magazines, even, was far larger than anybody ever, than anybody believed. And when I was with the Missouri Review, we had a pretty darn large subscription base, probably larger than any university based magazine. And one of the things that I would do is, you know, as God, I hate to admit this, out loud, but was direct marketing campaign.
Uh-huh.
And so I was sending junk mail, and I was buying mailing lists from other literary magazines and from other different kinds of things, and crunching them together, purging and coding and testing and doing all that, but. One of the side products of that is when you merged and purged, so that I'd get five or six or seven mailing lists,
right?
And merge them together, and you only wanted to send one piece to the same person,
right?
And so you'd figure out how many subscribers.
Uh-huh.
The various magazines had in common, and it was never more than 5%.
Right.
So if we had 7,000 subscribers, and somebody else had 2,000, and somebody else had 3,000, and somebody else had 1,500, well, those are all different people.
Right.
And, I did surveys that said that the average Missouri Review back then was, that we mailed out. I did reader subscriber surveys, the average magazine was read by three people.
Right.
Well, so what does that do to your readership?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people out there willing to read good stuff if you engage them.
Right.
The problem is, how do you get the thing in front of them, at the right time, the right piece of work in front of the right reader at the right time.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that work you did then was probably why the Missouri Review was able to marshal all that support to save it when the university was trying to shut it down.
Oh, it was.
Absolutely. And maybe that's the key we're both looking for. If someone wants to, resuscitate and build a literary readership, is to find someone to do that dirty work of making the links between people.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty now is that it's too costly to do it through the mail and doing it through the internet is so fragmented.
Right.
I mean, that really is the challenge of the social networking, is that although it certainly can come together in huge ways on occasion, you know, and things, you know, as they say, can go viral, or, you know, you can something all of a sudden for a couple of days can grab 10 minutes of attention for millions and millions of people. But how do you repackage that in a way that you know, you're going to find readers for a larger thing? And that part of the social network is still really fragmented.
Right.
You know, you have too often, I think, the same 10 people talking to each other all the time.
Right.
On the, you know. And that's not always the case. Sometimes something blows up and really, really works. But how that happens is still a mystery. I don't know how.
Well, maybe we'll figure it out. That might be a good place to leave it there. Thank you very much for talking with me today about this. It was wonderful. It was fascinating.
Well, thanks for inviting me into the conversation.
Sure. All right, there you have it, my conversation with Greg Michelson. I hope you enjoyed it. Greg and I had a great time, I think. Let's see. Oh, in 2 weeks, we'll have my conversation with Lynn Sloan. She's the author of the new novel, Principles of Navigation. That was a great conversation. You're going to like that one. And hopefully at the second show at the end of March will be my first reboot of the Shop Talk episodes with my new partner. So I'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.